This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon on this miserable old mozzy old day. Hope you have your lights on. If you're traveling, my goodness, you'll have your lights on in the house for sure. It's awful dark out there, isn't it? The Newfoundland and Labrador Young Farmers Forum held its 7th annual leadership summit in Gander over the weekend. The future of food in Canada relies on the success of farmers, and the Young Farmers Forum explored ways for farmers to expand their businesses and explore new areas of agriculture as well as sustainable practices. Well, my guests today, two of them you will no doubt know. One of them might be a little new to us, so we'll explore all this now in a moment. But my guests today are dairy farmer and secretary treasurer of the Young Farmers, Nancy Lester. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Great. Nelson Fagan, of course, raises cattle, the famous Fagan family in CBS. He's also chair of the cattlemen in Newfoundland and Labrador. Hello, Nelson.
Good afternoon.
And Stephanie Lipp, who might be a new name to a lot of people here, is a mushroom farmer who moved to Bonavista from Ontario. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So, Nancy, let's start with you. What sort of topics were raised at the recent forum?
We talked about a lot of important things, actually. We had some inspiring speakers mostly from Eastern Canada there. And the biggest thing we talked about was sustainability and how important that is now, especially we're trying to lower our carbon footprint and with climate change and everything going on. And we also talked about marketing our product and how important it is to make sure we tell our story.
Oh, for certain. And I know marketing has been an issue in this province for quite some time because it's not always that easy to get on those store shelves.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure.
I understand one of the topics that was raised was agronomy. Now, this is a new concept for me. No doubt you guys are all entrenched in this sort of thing. What is agronomy?
Nelson, you want to speak up with that one?
No. that's very new to me, actually.
We learned a lot ourselves on that as well. Like I said, I'm still learning. Like, I'm a sixth-generation dairy farmer, and I'm still learning new things every day. So one of our speakers, Cedric McLeod, he was speaking on lowering our carbon footprint and making sure we were taking steps to protect our environment and doing that so for our future. I have two kids, so I hope that they will want to continue on farming and hopefully be seventh-generation dairy farmers here in Brookfield Road. So anything we can do to help protect the environment would definitely be a big thing, important thing.
For certain, and my understanding, and this is just a quick Google some time ago, and I don't even know if I've got this right, but agronomy has something to do with ensuring that the soil remains nutrient full without putting too many pesticides and all of that, and you know, those kinds of artificial things in the soil.
Absolutely. I feel like our chair, Susan Lester, who is the farm that grows all the vegetables and stuff, she would definitely know about that topic for sure.
For certain, but it touches on a lot of different types of agriculture in Newfoundland and Labrador. And Nelson, you're a beef farmer in CBS. How long have you and your family been at it?
I'll be fifth generation on the butchering side itself, but the vegetable side goes back a little bit further.
Is that right? Five generations, just imagine.
And, there's a saying here, Fagans don't like the water. I don't remember one of us ever being a fisherman, to be honest with you.
So you've always been in this type of business. Have you been able to expand the business? Have you still got the same kind of operation, or has it grown? Give us a little history of your family and beef farming.
Well, back in the day, my family started just a small butcher slaughterhouse here in the community. And it wasn't until my grandfather kind of changed it when he purchased Lawler's Meats on Duckworth Street in 1964 upon Max Lawler's retirement. And then he diversed into, he had contracts with the government for beef in their kitchens, the prison, the hospitals, and that's where Granddad got his foot in the door. But on top of that, he later stepped out and opened up a pig farm. So he got into that, and then, of course, with the crash of that in the mid-'80s, somewhat died out, and he sold the pig operation later. So we got more on into cattle and vegetables.
And do you find that they sort of complement each other? How does that work?
Well, once we start harvest, we have a lot of waste, which we grind up, like when we start bunching carrot and turnip, anything that's number two, number three, we just grind up for animal feed. So we're able to be sustainable in that way, right?
Oh, well, no doubt. And I would imagine it also goes to help fertilize the ground as well.
Exactly. And upon having enough of our own manure, we also give a bit to our local farmers here in the area who do row crops.
And any gardener knows how it's so strange, but they're all so excited over manure.
Exactly. It's one thing that you need. And, of course, with the carbon being driven this day and age, we're getting more and more into using cover crops and things like this. Keep your soil covered 12 months of the year to lock that in.
Now, speaking of manure, this is where we bring Stephanie in, because I imagine manure is a little bit of is something that you need in mushroom farming.
Well, yes. Typically, for traditional white-button mushrooms, they are definitely grown in manure. But when my co-founder Leo and I started thinking about what kind of business we wanted to do when we came to Bonavista, Vista, mushrooms were brought up. But I used to actually hate mushrooms because they were grown in manure, and it was just, I know it's really good for growing things, but I just didn't like the smell and the idea of it. So the varieties we grow are gourmet mushrooms, which are wood decomposers. So we actually grow them on hardwood sawdust that has extra nutrients added to it. So we actually don't use any manure in our growth, and we get those nutrients in different ways. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a different thing. And it's grown on a much smaller scale. If anyone's ever seen photos of the white-butted mushroom farms, they're huge, huge indoor spaces, and we grow indoors but on a much smaller scale, and we're basically handling each fruiting bag individually, and that's where the mushrooms grow out of a bag, and they grow out in beautiful little clusters.
Well, that's, and I want to talk to you a little bit more about what brought you here and why mushrooms when we come back after the break. My guests today are three people making a living at agriculture in Newfoundland and Labrador. They are Nancy Lester, Nelson Fagan, and Stephanie Lipp. We'll be back right after this.
Saturday morning, join us for the Irish Newfoundland Show. Send your request to irishnl@vocm.com or submit them online at vocm.com.
Making a go of it in Newfoundland and Labrador in the world of agriculture. They include the Secretary Treasurer of the Young Farmers, Nancy Lester, Nelson Fagan, Chair of the Cattlemen Association in Newfoundland and Labrador, and Stephanie Lipp is a mushroom farmer in Bonavista. And Nancy, of course, we talked about the history of the Fagan family in CBS, but the Lesters are storied right across Newfoundland and Labrador. How far back do the Lesters go?
The Lesters are gone back almost 200 years now, I would imagine. They started back with just a couple cows and growing their own vegetables. And then my dad and my mom and my uncle and aunt, my dad and mom took over the dairy side of it, and my uncle and my aunt took over the vegetable part of it. So we kind of conquered and divided and then specialized in those areas.
And you're on the dairy side, is that correct?
That's right, yep. And so, actually, we just switched to robotic dairy farming.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. So how does your operation currently work?
So right now, we have four robots. We started back in February, and they run 24/7. So now the cow gets to decide pretty well when she wants to come and get milked. So they get a little bit of feed in while they're getting milked, and that's why they want, I like to call it candy. And they come on up whenever they want to get milked. At least we're at average about 2.7 times a day per cow of milking.
That's interesting. So they just sort of wander in, say, hey, you know, I think it's time. How does that work?
Yeah, they're such smart animals. They had to learn so much. This we all had to learn. It was a learning curve for myself and my brother and parents and husband, and it was also a learning curve for the cows. But we can tell that they're just so happy and healthy, and they really enjoy this transition. So once they we've kind of got them trained that when their udders get full, they want to get the milk out and they want to get a treat, so they come on up to the robots, and the robots will go ahead and milk them. We don't have to actually, us as farmers, don't have to actually put the milker on anymore. it's amazing to watch. We're all still amazed with it.
I'm trying to visualize this because we all are familiar with the stalls and those big machines pumping and all that stuff. And they're sitting in a stall with a feed trough in front of them and all that good stuff.
Right,
but this is different. How does this look?
Yeah, you're kind of gone back even when my dad was younger. That would be a Thai-style barn. What we had previous was a parallel parlor. So we turn all the cows up twice a day or three times a day, depending on if we had the workers to do so. But we'd have to turn the cows up, and then we'd put the milkers on them and milk them out. But now the stalls are still all there, and they can lie down, they can eat, they can drink, they can get a back scratch, they can do whatever they want when they want to, and then when they feel that they want to go get some grain, some candy, I call it, they'll come on up to the robots and they get milked in there. It's amazing.
So does it attach itself or how does it work?
It's a robotic arm, and it has a little laser camera on it, and it can actually see the teats, and it cleans them all off, and it's able to test for if there's any abnormalities into the milk, and so it won't put it into the milk tank. It'll dump it, and it's able to tell us. There's a lot more of computer work that we're finding that we have to sit down and look at charts and stuff. So it's definitely a different way of farming, but with the way that society is going, and it's so hard to get employees now, it was definitely the right move to make.
And is this 24/7? I mean, you say it's whenever the cows feel like coming on in.
Yeah. So previously we used to milk at 5 in the morning and 5 at the evening. And so it would take about 4 to 5 hours to milk the 250, 300 cows. But now that it's running 24/7, it doesn't stop. It's constantly going.
And you say the cows like it?
They love it. They absolutely love it. Yeah. All the people that we've had into our farms, we're having to do ProAction, which is Canadian quality milk, making sure that we're producing good milk and stuff. Everyone is just amazed at how well our cows, they look so much more comfortable. They just look relaxed, and it was a great adjustment.
Nelson, I want to come back to you in a moment, but we were just touching the surface of what Stephanie's involved in Bonavista, Vista, and I wanted to circle back for a moment and just ask her a little bit about her history. Stephanie, you're from Ontario, is that correct?
Yes, from Mississauga, just outside of Toronto.
So very different from Bonavista.
Yes.
What attracted you to Bonavista? How did you end up there?
Leo is originally from Port-au-Prince in Stephenville, but he grew up in Ontario, so we did have that connection to Newfoundland, and I had visited and thought it was super beautiful. And basically, we came across the articles about Bonavista and all the entrepreneurs that are calling it home and its resurgence, so we thought it could be a place where we could start our own business and be part of a vibrant community. So just in a very few months' time, we found a house, started researching growing mushrooms, and then loaded all of our stuff and our cats into our car and made the drive over. So it happened really quickly, but it just was the kind of change that we wanted from, the crazy housing market and jobs we didn't love in Ontario. So it gave us this opportunity to not start over. We weren't starting from scratch, but yeah, it just gave us a new adventure.
Fantastic. So how long have you been there now?
About 2.5 years now we've been here.
So just getting your feet wet, so to speak. Why mushrooms?
Leo had had a love of mushrooms for a really long time. He used them as supplements, and he had also started buying them regularly at a local farmer's market. And so with my background in entrepreneurship and his background in loving mushrooms and learning how they grew, and then also when we started researching Newfoundland and learning about food insecurity and things like that, it really just all came together as the perfect business to make our own little contribution to alleviating some barriers to food, especially in rural places. And it was just super interesting. Like, even to this day, we are learning new and amazing things about mushrooms, about fungi, how incredible they are as a species. So it's just a never-ending source of fascination for us.
Indeed, I saw a show not too long ago that fungus is really reason why there is life on Earth. It's really quite fascinating. But you specialize in the wood decomposers. You're not the white cap mushrooms that we're used to seeing in the grocery stores. You're doing some different types of breeds. What are you looking at?
So the ones that we have right now are a blue oyster and black pearl oyster, which I would say are the ones that people are most familiar with in the gourmet varieties. And then we have shiitake, lion's mane, cinnamon cap, and beach mushrooms. So those all have their own appearance and flavor and texture characteristics, but they can all be used, like you can use any white button mushroom. So there's not too much of an actual learning difference, but people are just not used to seeing them. So when we're at the farmer's market, we really just have to educate people to, you know, tell them why they taste so good and how they're easy to use. And the best part is that they're, you know, haven't been picked more than, you know, a few hours overnight or in the morning. So they're super fresh. They haven't been sat on a, you know, the ferry in a truck for several days.
And freshness makes all the difference, doesn't it? Especially when you're talking about gourmet meals and the like.
Yes, for mushrooms, it really does. Just unfortunately, people have seen them in the grocery store and they don't always look that great when they've traveled. So we have to, you know, be like, this is what you see in the grocery store. It looks so much better and it's so much fresher. And you don't get that sliminess that sometimes people associate with mushrooms or that musty smell. Like, they really are high quality.
And tasty, no doubt. I find a lot of stuff that you get in grocery stores, are pumped up with something, water usually, I guess. I don't know if that's the case with mushrooms, but you often lose a lot of the taste. You'll know instantly when something's locally grown.
Yeah, definitely. They taste just so much better, and they're not wilty. There's more of a meatiness. The mushrooms are made of a lot of water, so once they've been sat for a long time, they'll either get dry and wrinkly from losing the water, or when they're wrapped in plastic, they'll have like a lot of condensation and not a great texture to them.
My guests today on Target are three local members of the agricultural community, farmers, Nancy Lester, Nelson Fagan, and Stephanie Lipp. When we come back, we'll talk to Nelson again a little bit about his operation right after this.
Got plans for midnight? Bring your VOCM along with the best soundtrack for every night anywhere. The VOCM All Night Show, midnight on your VOCM.
And I'm speaking to three young farmers in Newfoundland and Labrador. There was a Young Farmers Forum recently in Gander, and among them is Nelson Fagan. He's been a cattle farmer all his life. It was passed down to him through his family. So, Nelson, how many head of cattle do you raise?
Currently, there's 22 here right now. However, we do a lot of buying and selling. We buy a lot from other local producers in America to sell only local.
Right, that was what I was going to ask. Who are your markets?
Well, we have six or seven now, and one more store to come on, including Lester's Farm Market. And I do a lot of on the road, going to rural Newfoundland communities. I go with like Marystown, Buren, Fogel Island, I've been as far as Cornerbrook.
So you're doing the raising and the marketing, it sounds like.
Well, the girlfriend does most of the marketing. I can't be in two places at once, but... I try. You know, it's early mornings, late nights, but we make a go of it with two small kids.
I was going to say, it's a real lifestyle, isn't it? I mean, you have to be committed night and day.
You have to love what you do. When you know, it's like having another 30 children, because they got to be seen to morning, noon, night, picked up after, bed. I mean, you can't have a vacation. I mean, it took me and Kayla some... digging around to find somebody to watch a 4 and a 7-year-old just to go for this past weekend. So, you know, it's really no life.
So how long does it take to raise a beef cow to market?
We try to finish them out at 16, 17 months. So you can go as long as 20, 22, but the cuts of meat there are getting really big, and not everybody in the local market seems to want really big. My dad calls them dinosaur steaks.
And what kind of feed do you use? Do you grass feed them, or do you supplement that with grain? How does that work?
Well, they go on pasture from usually the community pastures here open second Saturday of June, and they'll run until the grass dries up. This year we brought them home the last Saturday of October, so they've been home now a month. And when they come home off the grass, they go onto hay and forage. And we also take advantage of distiller's grains from local breweries, as well as buying in corn.
And do they really benefit from, you know, being out there as opposed to being, you know, penned in?
Oh, yes. Totally different animals. It's night and day. It's night and day. You have an animal in the barn. When it comes time to handle them, they're on edge. You find them short-tempered. Whereas you have them outside... And like our cattle we just built a new barn, 64 by 40. And we plan to use that for calving only. Other than that, the rest of the year, animals are outside 95% of the year.
As the chair of the Cattlemen Association, there's been a real push, of course, to expand the province's beef production. What's needed for a successful beef operation?
Successful beef operation, from the side of raising cattle, very little. You just need ample space, some very low-maintenance handling facility, and most of the time they can be raised outside. Like we calved outdoors this winter. We had calves born in snowstorms, and we had some blankets we put on them. Everything's fine. But it's growing here, and as the Cattlemen Association, we just teamed up last year with the provincial government, and we imported 200 head of purebred beef cattle to boost the genetics here on the island, which was a major success.
So you raise about 22, you say. So how does that work? Do you hold some back to create new cows in the spring, or how does that work?
Oh, yes. This year we're going to keep back three of the five heifers that we have. Everything with us, we breed purebred Charolais beef cattle, and we are actually the first registered purebred Charolais beef cattle breeder in this province's history. So we started that and joined up with them, brought in Charolais cattle, and continued to breed them. So everything with us is pedigreed. Everything is artificial insemination. We just purchased a purebred Charolais bull, and me and my girlfriend drove to Nova Scotia back in April to pick him up personally. He's a pedigreed animal, paid a substantial amount of money for him, but it's all to build genetics and move forward with top quality beef.
And how long do you typically keep a bull around?
Well, he bred some animals this year, so usually 3 years, because by the time he's 3 years of age, if you're retaining your own heifers and not buying none in, by the time he hits 3 years on your farm, he's going to start to breed his own daughters if you do not replace him, right?
Right, so you have to keep all of that in mind.
Exactly. So, and now we do have several pastures that we deal with. So when breeding season comes, we can put him or his daughters on separate pastures and maybe get a fourth year out of him. And it's also depending on the bull itself. Like when bulls get up 4 or 5 years old, they tend to go, my dad calls it a midlife crisis. some of them become, sometimes they become aggressive. The bull's attitude changes. Like they become aggressive. Some of them will just lie down and not want to do nothing and eat. They're mentalities just change. So as long as he doesn't try anything silly, as we like to call it, and hurt anybody, we'll keep him for as long as we can and just keep moving him and his daughters around.
Yeah, because bulls can be tricky.
Well, they can be temperamental, and the thing is, I guarantee you the first one to haul in his horns, as Dad says, will be you.
That's right. You're not going to fool around with a bull, that's for sure.
No, they have the weight to throw around, that's for sure.
They exactly. They have a reputation for a good reason. Is access to pasture land an issue across Newfoundland and Labrador?
It has been, but lately the government has been looking into the community pastures and doing some investigating and getting out and looking at them and seeing what pastures are ran down and not being kept up. And they have been taking some LTOs, canceling some LTOs from some people and putting them out to tender for new people to be interested in looking after pastures. And one such pasture, me and several people in my community formed a committee that we heard had been taken back, and we actually got approved for the LTO for a community pasture next to us.
Oh, that's fantastic, because, I mean, community pastures used to be a lot more common than they are now. Do you find more communities sort of taking, so to speak, the bull by the horns and creating these pasture spaces?
There are a lot of people serious about beef development in this province, and a lot of them have already stepped up and have taken over other pastures, and the guys, everybody here, we have wonderful beef producers in this island, and we're all serious about moving this forward and helping one another.
Can you raise beef cattle without having to slaughter them, or do you sort of need that facility nearby or on your property?
You need one nearby. The government just helped out two local producers build two new abattoirs, one's in Hopewell and one's, I believe the other one's in Cormac. And those guys are now in production and doing well, to the best of my knowledge, as I last spoke to the last two lads.
You mentioned you raise Charolais cattle. What are their qualities? What are they like, and why have you gone that route?
Well, they're a continental breed. They're originally from France, Charolais Valley, and they're all snow white. They're beautiful animals. There is a red strain. You can get, what color, red factor. I don't have any. But you can get that. And the qualities, they're more so good when you cross them up. Like growing up, Dad and my granddad were Hereford people. And every time we had Charolais and we crossed into them, we always had fabulous offspring and wonderful carcass qualities. So I always had a soft spot for Charolais cattle. I always wanted them. And, of course, granddad and dad were Hereford people, so that kind of didn't happen. Once I broke out on my own, I decided, well, hey, I can have what breed I want now, and that's what I went with.
Yeah, because I think it's the Hereford that we often think of when we think of beef cattle, that American or British breed. I'm going to bring Nancy back into the conversation now. We're talking about breeds of cattle. What do you use? Is it primarily Holstein?
Yeah, we're Holstein herd here, yep.
And what is it about the Holstein that makes it good for you?
The Holsteins are known for milk production. The Jerseys are more known for fat in the milk. But as for milk production and the quantity, you'd go with the Holstein cows.
And are they primarily what most dairy farmers in Newfoundland and Labrador use?
Yep, I think there's one farm that's Ayrshire, which is a reddish brown and white. Like, it looks like the Holstein is black and white, but it's actually red and brownish colors. And there's a couple of farms, too, that will have a bit of cross jerseys that might be in there, but for the most part, Holstein is the most common.
Are there any traditional breeds that you've used or that have traditionally been used in Newfoundland and Labrador going back over the centuries?
No, we've always, as far as best of my knowledge, we've always had just the Holsteins here on Brookfield Road.
And they're good producers, too. I understand the volume is pretty consistent.
Yeah, they're known. That's right. And when we pick out, because we don't do natural breeding for the most part here, we do artificial. So my brother, when he picks out the genetics, he's looking for, that kind of stuff, milk quantity and their conformation of the animal and such.
So how does that go? Do you order sperm? How does that happen?
Yep, there's semen salesmen that come around to the farm. Nelson uses them too sometimes.
Yes.
It's so interesting because I think for people who are not involved in the business side of it, this all seems so, I don't know, clinical, but you have to be, don't you?
Absolutely. You have to be a jack of all trades to be in the farming industry. Like, there's going to be days that, like Nelson said, it's tough to make a go, but you can't give up, because when you get it going, there's especially with a family business, it's a wonderful business to be in.
So you don't deal with any bulls then? You're all the girls there.
Yeah, mostly girls. Dad holds on to a couple bulls, but girls are winning here on Brookfield Road for sure.
we'll come back after the break to speak more with our farmers, Nancy Lester, Nelson Fagan, and Stephanie Lipp, who I'm going to ask a little bit more about mushroom farming when we come back right after this.
Take a break. Join us weekdays from 12:30 to 1 p.m. as we discuss anything and everything that's happening now. It's all on the table during your VOCM lunch break.
The Young Farmers Forum was held in Gander on the weekend. We're talking to three young farmers in Newfoundland and Labrador. You just heard from Nelson Fagan and Nancy Lester. But Stephanie Lipp has developed a mushroom farm in Bonavista along with her partner, Leo. And Stephanie, what does a mushroom farm look like?
There's a few different aspects to it. One of the things people probably wouldn't imagine is that there's a lot of laboratory work involved in growing mushrooms. We deal with a lot of DNA strains of different types of mushrooms that have different qualities. So there's people that actually create these strains in a lab. So they probably don't grow too much, but they're very into the part of it. So we can order mushrooms that grow well in colder temperatures, ones that are better in hot temperatures, ones that are hybrids. So that's what a black pearl oyster is, a blue oyster and a king oyster mixed together. And then we can pick out, the qualities that, suit our farm. So there's a lab, which also includes a flow hood, which is basically a box that pushes HEPA-filtered air into our workspace, because we need to keep everything super, super clean and sanitary. Any competing organisms or bacteria will actually take over the mushroom spores and won't allow them to grow, and then we'll get other things like, penicillins or other, regular molds that you find on an apple, so we have to make sure that those are kept completely away. And so that way we know when we actually grow mushrooms, we've kept everything clean and sanitary. And then we have the actual grow room, which is a room that is climate controlled. So we need to look at temperature, airflow, humidity, and light. Our mushrooms don't need too much light, but they need a little bit. Trying to mimic the changing of the day on the forest floor, so like kind of dappled shaded light. They like high humidity, but not too high, or else again we can introduce bacteria growth. And then temperature. So as it's generally colder here in Bonavista, we have strains that like the cold weather, which kind of backfired this summer when it was a super hot summer in Bonavista and everything unfortunately died for a few weeks because it was just way too hot and we didn't have any way to keep the temperature cool enough. So those are things we learn about as mushroom farmers, that always be aware of unexpectedly super hot summers in Bonavista. And then we have an area where we fill the bags with the sawdust and we sterilize them in pressure cookers. So we do 8 at a time, and we do that 4 times a day. So we're always churning out the bags, introducing the spores, which is called inoculating, and then bringing them to the grow room.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, some people may not be aware, but fungi, there's no seeds, they grow from spores. So how does the propagation work?
So we do it in a couple different steps. So when we first order our DNA, we like to kind of elongate so that we can use it several times. So first it'll go from whatever test tube or petri dish it comes from the supplier in, and then that will go into several more petri dishes with a neutral agar in it. And that will go into kind of long-term storage. And then as we need to, we'll take one of those plates and then introduce it to a grain spawn bag, which just gives it some extra nutrients. But we wouldn't be able to do that for all our growing because it'd be too expensive. We just do it for this first step. And then from there, it'll go into sawdust bags, and each one of those sawdust bags can do 10 more. So we don't do it too many times because the more elongate it, you can get mutations and things like that. But just a few generations down the road are fine. So yeah, it goes from the petri dish to grain and then to 2 generations of sawdust.
That's so interesting. So how much space do you need for this? Like how big are your greenhouses, for want of a better word?
Right now I think ours is 150, 200 square feet, and we have shelves, so we can employ vertical farming methods. We can stack them to a certain extent. We still need some breathing room, and they can actually generate heat, so we need to keep them separate enough that the heat won't bother them. But it's not huge down here. We call ourselves a micro farm at this point, but we're just limited by space. So as we grow our farm, we can really grow exponentially once we get height and breadth of our farm space.
And what are your markets looking like right now?
Pretty good. I mean, Bonavista is a seasonal community. But last February, during the second lockdown, actually, we were able to launch our subscription service. So now we deliver mushrooms weekly to people in communities from Bonavista to Clarenville. So that makes us, we have a certain set customer base that we know we're catering to. And then between the end of June until mid-December, we're at the Clarenville Farm Market weekly. So then we're engaging with, the market at large. And we're working on plans to have our facility licensed so that we can get into grocery stores and things like that. But that requires a bit more regulatory compliance to have a secondary step to sell our product.
You touched on that just a moment ago, but what do you typically do then in the off season? Is it all preparation for the coming season?
We have enough weekly customers that keep us going through the winter. They're very, very dedicated, amazing customers that love our product. We keep it going. We're just able to control our output so that it's not going into waste. And then we spend the off season also doing marketing for the next season, market development and market research.
Of course, Nancy, there's no such thing as an off season in dairy, is there?
No, there's not. Just the winters are supposed to be a little bit less busy than the summers because we're not harvesting forage and that. But no, we're kept pretty busy.
It's supposed to be, as you say, but it sounds like it's not.
No, it's not. No, it definitely doesn't happen that way, but we're glad that we're kept going anyhow.
For certain. So you do propagate some of your own feed, is that right?
Yep. We are self-sufficient in forage. That's just your regular grasses here, but we do have to bring in all of our grains. And since the COVID, the pandemic has hit, all the prices have just skyrocketed. So it's different times for sure.
And anybody who's driven through the Goulds, for instance, knows those big, beautiful fields going up over the hills. And that is that part of your operation? Do you just let the girls go out and do their thing?
No, the Goulds, there's lots of dairy farms actually in the Goulds. Some of the, I'm not privy to what, who lets their cows out or whatnot, but no, that's not us in there.
No, but do you still let them out? Do you have like plenty of land to just let them wander around and eat grains and clover?
Our cows, no. So yeah, we just take the grass off of, we do have some fields into the Burnt Hills, we call it, in the Goulds there. But here around our farm, no, we haven't let the cows out since, I'd say my pop was around and he's passed back in 2001. So that's a thing of the past these days. You'll find a lot of farms now aren't doing that. Just with our terrain on the ground and stuff, it's tough on their hooves. These animals are just they're working all the time, so it's best for them to be safe in the barn. They're able to get the water, the food, socialize, get a back scratch, lie down, get milked whenever they want, so they're kept inside.
I like that idea of socializing.
Yes, oh, they do that. There's a, just like people, there's little cliques going around, the same girls like hanging out with the same ones.
Do you find the same thing, Nelson?
Oh, definitely. You will see, like, especially among the yearling heifers and stuff, like, quite often you have animals here on the farm ourselves, and when the summer pasture opens, it's very common to go there and see two or three heifers buddied up together, and they will graze together, lay down together, and then when they come home in the fall, they'll spend all winter in the paddock by themselves in one corner, and there'll be another group in another corner. They have their own... They're posses. It's like your group of high school friends. It's the same.
Is it true that they all graze in the same direction?
No.
So TV has lied to me?
No. Don't believe everything. Only believe half of what you hear, nothing that you see.
Is there an off-season in the beef industry?
No, there's no off-season. It's hard for us. Trying to keep animals on... at market-ready slaughter weight year-round is an issue, but we're working on that. This new barn is a part of our strategy going forward to deal with that. And, you know, I don't get a whole lot of time. I rely a lot on my dad and my brother off the season. My brother goes to work at 6 a.m. He's home at 6, and he's still helping me in the evenings until 10:30, 11 o'clock in the night. And I myself have a job by trade. I'm a carpenter with a construction company in town. So I start work at 6:30 and I get off at 4:30. So it's not easy.
Is it a family affair? Does it need to be a family affair?
Yes, it does. If you want to progress and you can't afford labor, it definitely needs to be a family affair. And without my dad and my brother, I'd be in hard shape.
Is it, you know, and again, you mentioned that, but you see a lot of farmers who are at it well up into their 70s. You know, is it hard on the body? Is there a point where you say, oh, I can't do this anymore?
Well, yes, actually it is. And my dad is going through that now. Years of standing to a meat saw, his fingers lock up and they won't open. So he has to get these shots and what have you. And it's like my dad said, you know, his mind is go, go, go. But his body is no, no, no. And that's the thing. You get age takes toll on everybody. And you see these older farmers still doing it. And a good part of that is the mentality and the love for what they do. And the other part of that is no one's around to do it.
So how important is it to have those succession plans, I suppose, Nelson? And I'll ask Nancy the same thing in a moment.
It's very important to have that kind of stuff. I mean, you always got to build for the future what you can do. And every technique there can be to make something easier, do it. I mean, it's like my granddad used to say, why was a machine invented if it wasn't to make a man's life easier? Take advantage of these things. And that's what I intend to do going forward, like many of us in agriculture will have to.
And Nancy, you're doing the same thing with this robotic milking, which I find fascinating. You're going to have to send me pictures.
Oh, absolutely. I'll send you videos.
is succession you know, an important part of what you do as well? Or think
absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. It's for sure. It's our succession plan is in process. I don't know if it'll ever be done. But my mom and dad, they'll never retire. They're their mid to late 60s now, and my brother and I don't want them to retire. They're such main parts of our farm. And it's just, we just try to focus them on too, like, get out and do more stuff of what you want to do now, not having to do, we'll take care of my brother looks after all the alarms. The alarms from the robots are going off any time of the night, so he's having to get up and come down and check it out. And we'll tell mom and dad, no, you guys don't worry about that. But dad's down in the barn, he's feeding the cows twice a day. Like I said, he'll never retire, and nor do we want him to. But it's quite a process. The succession is definitely a process.
Well, Nancy Nelson, you've come by your professions honestly, passed down generation to generation. As Stephanie, you stuck your neck out. You came here. Good luck, and all the best to you. I appreciate your time, all three of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and all the best. And we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening.